So tonight I'm going to talk about the Buddha and nature, and maybe a few other things will slip in there. So in the Buddhist teachings, there is no creator of heaven and earth, and there is no tale of creation either, which most religions have some more or less believable story about how the world was created and how humans were created and so on, but in Buddhism there is no story. So there is no higher authority or God who has appointed man as the owner and the caretaker or steward of the earth. Buddhism sees humankind as an integrated part of nature. When we destroy nature, we destroy ourselves. And in this view of life, Buddhism is in accordance with the old shamanistic beliefs that most indigenous people all over the earth has practiced since the beginning of time, and that still survives in certain places. So among the American Indian tribes, this relationship between the nature, the animals, and the humans was pointed out many times. And this can, for example, be heard in the speech of Chief Seattle that was held at the Treaty Council in Washington, 1854. And it's said that the original speech was jotted down by somebody, and then in 1970 a writer named Ted Perry found it, and he recreated it like this. So we cannot be sure that this is the exact words that Chief Seattle actually said, but it's something like this anyway. This we know: the earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. This we know: all things are connected, like the blood that unites one family. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the children of the earth. Man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself. So this symbol of the web or the net, that it's a very old symbol for this interconnectedness of life. So in the Buddhist mythology, it's called the net of Indra. And it has a pearl in every mesh, and all these pearls are reflecting all the other pearls. And in Scandinavian old religion, the Asatru, and even before that, we have the web of Urd, which is one of the eldest of the Norns, the goddesses of destiny in the old religion. Native Americans have Spider Woman as some sort of a symbol for this. And nowadays we also have the World Wide Web, of course. That's our symbol. So when the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree meditating with the intention of to find out the meaning of life, he was assaulted by Mara. Mara is this mythological figure that sort of personifies the hindrances. So doubt arose in his mind. Was he really worthy to become a fully awakened being, a Buddha? So then he reached down and his hand and touched the earth. And you can see in many Buddha statues that this he has this right hand touching the earth. And he asked the earth goddess for confirmation and reassurance. And she answered by shaking and rumbling a little bit. And then he was sure that his time had come after so many lifetimes of deep practice. And then Mara disappeared into thin air. So then that night, while sitting under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha became fully enlightened and became the Buddha, our Buddha. And in the Buddha's teaching, he talks about the interconnectedness of all things and the respect for Mother Earth that sustains us all. One meaning of Dhamma is the laws of nature. And in the stories about the birth and life of the Buddha, it's said that he was born in a grove of tall and beautiful sal trees. And when he was a child, once he meditated under a rose apple tree. And he attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, which is a form of ficus called ficus religiosa in Latin. And finally he died under two sal trees in the village of Kusinara. And the trees bloomed out of season above his deathbed. So different trees form a red thread through the life of the Buddha. And nature spirits and devas that we've talked a bit about here sometimes, it's also a part of traditional Buddhist mythology, as well as in the shamanistic type traditions. Because most cultures have some form of elves, gnomes, or the little people that live under the earth and other nature spirits of different kinds that we usually can't see, but they live here among us. In out in nature. So there is this story about a monk, and he cut off a big branch from a tree, and he had been a carpenter earlier, and he wanted to make something out of this branch. But the tree spirit that lived in this tree complained to the Buddha that one of his monks had cut off this arm of his tree child. And after that, the Buddha made a rule for the monks against cutting down any living tree. So he told everybody to treat trees with care and respect, since they unselfishly provide shade and shelter and fruit for all beings that either live there in the tree or just happens to pass by on their way. And so he often said to his monks and nuns when they were out walking, you know, he spent 30 years walking around India, and he very often said, here are trees and the roots of trees. Let us sit here and meditate. So long time ago, I was doing a retreat in Burma at a center called the Mahasi Sasana Yekta. And every day, going from where we stayed, the women's quarters, to the meditation hall, I passed by this very big and impressive banyan tree that stood by itself between two buildings. And very often I saw people bowing to this tree. They're standing in front of the tree and bowing. And I was wondering, I had my theories about that there was some tree spirit living there, or some holy tree or something. So one day I asked the Sayadaw, the teacher, why they were bowing to this tree. And the Sayadaw, he just laughed, and that he didn't laugh very often, but this time he did. No, they're not bowing to the tree. They are bowing to the Shwedagon Pagoda that lies on the hill beyond the tree. So when you stand at a certain point in front of this tree, you can see the pagoda there far away up on the hill. So that was the end of my illusion that they were all worshipping this tree. So during the time of the Buddha, the monks and nuns were mostly living outside in nature under large trees. And they were directly dependent on nature's benevolence. And in many of the scriptures, there are these very lyrical descriptions of nature and its inhabitants. And so, especially in a book in the Pali canon called Theragata, the Songs of the Elders, there are some of these poems that the ones I'm going to read is by one of the Buddha's monks, one of his favorite monks, Mahakasapa. And he used to like to walk in the nature and to sit there and meditate, and he talks in other poems about how wonderful it was to do the jhanas out in the nature. So, this is something that he writes about these hills where he used to roam around. Spread with garlands of vines, places delighting the mind, resounding with elephants, appealing, those rocky crags refresh me. The color of blue, dark clouds glistening, cooled with the water of clear flowing streams, covered with ladybugs. Those rocky crags refresh me. Their lovely surfaces wet with rain, mountains frequented by seers and echoing with peacocks. Those rocky crags refresh me, uncrowded by householders, frequented by monkeys and deer, covered with moss and water weeds. Those rocky crags refresh me. That was Mahakasapa. So when the monks and nuns, or mostly the monks actually, were living out in nature like that, and just under trees and so, their neighbors were of course all kinds of animals, just like he says here, mentions elephants and monkeys and deers and peacocks and everything. So in the Vinaya, which is the book that contains all the rules for monks and nuns, it says that it's forbidden to eat meat from certain wild animals like elephants, snakes, lions, tigers, leopards, bears, and hyenas. And the Buddha taught his disciples to send thoughts of metta, friendliness and kindness, to the wild animals in the forest. And this was only possible if they had no intention whatsoever to kill them or eat them. So in this way they could live in harmony with their wild neighbors. There was someone once before when I had gave this talk who asked about if there was any stories about monks being eaten by wild animals. And the only story I could think of then was, and I think that's the only story there is about monks getting eaten by tigers, and that is in the Jataka tales that Greg was mentioning, that the stories about the Buddha's lives before he became a Buddha when he was a bodhisattva. And once he was wandering around in nature and he came across this tigress that had just got babies, cubs, and she was so tired and worn out, and so she didn't have the strength to go hunting to feed herself. And he saw that she was more or less dying if he didn't. So then he just threw his body over this cliff, so, and offered it to her to eat. So that was a monk getting eaten by a tiger, but by his own will. Otherwise, they seem to be able to live in quite good harmony with all these wild neighbors. But there is no general rule against eating meat in Buddhism, which is something that is quite surprising for most people. There is a rule against killing animals yourself, or also to eat animals or meat that you know has been killed specially for you, and not, you know. And this was, of course, decided out of practical reasons, since the monks and nuns were totally dependent on food gifts from the people in the villages around. And they had to accept whatever was put in their bowls without discrimination. Any other behavior would have been seen as really ungrateful and strange, since the people there, and still do in Thailand, even though it's a Buddhist country, actually most Buddhist countries are not vegetarian. Some people are vegetarian, just like here, but most people eat meat. And the families gave of their own food. They just made some extra when they knew that the monks were coming around to collect alms food. And that whole system is still going on in Buddhist countries, and it's not usually, the monks aren't begging sort of randomly. It's usually a scheme, you know, one day we go, the monks go to this village or that group of houses, and next day they go somewhere else. And so the people already know when they're coming, and they have prepared something, whatever they happen to have. So still every morning in villages in Buddhist countries, and also in towns, you can see this line of monks walking barefoot with their bowls in a strap over their shoulder, and usually they walk with their eyes downcast, very humble, to collect food from the villagers that are then just waiting outside from front of their houses with their kids and everything. And it's seen as a privilege to practice this generosity and collect merit and good karma in this life and maybe also in future lives. And the monks give their teaching and counseling and ceremonies and whatever is needed in the society in the sort of spiritual way in return. And I know also that some monks are skilled in herbal medicine remedies or other healing arts or chanting. Even chanting can be for healing. And nowadays, even monks in Thailand, I know, are some of them are engaged in this environmental struggle to save some of the last forests. There's very little forest left in Thailand. It's all mostly exploited. And they can even ordain trees as monks, wrap saffron robes around them, and then the loggers don't dare to cut them down, because that would be a great, very bad karma to to kill a monk, even if it's a tree. And also in the Vinaya, there are the rules. There are also descriptions of how to build toilets and dispose of garbage, and it's strictly forbidden to pollute water, to throw leftovers or trash in lakes and rivers. So the Buddha was kind of conscious of the environment already then. And he often used water as a metaphor for the human mind. For example, think of a pond where the water is murky, agitated, and muddy. So is also an untrained and confused mind. Think of a pond where the water is calm like a mirror. You can see shells, stones, and schools of fish. So is also a trained and clear-seeing mind. So you can say that the Buddha was a scientist, curious to find out how things work. But instead of using outer means of measuring and experimenting, his method was to sharpen his own power of concentration and awareness to a degree where his mind could penetrate very deeply and discover the physical and mental realities in his own body. All of this universe is contained in this fathom-long body, is a saying. A fathom, I don't know exactly how long that it was, a measure that they used in those times. So it's, I guess it's about the length of a body, ordinary body. So in his explorations, meditations, the Buddha saw that all physical things and all other phenomena as well, thoughts and emotions, whatever comes up in our life, it's all impermanent, fleeting, unreliable. In Pali, this quality is called anicca, and that means impermanence, change. And it's one of the characteristics of life that Greg mentioned this morning too. So in the Diamond Sutra, it's expressed in the following poem. See this fleeting world as a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering light, a phantom and a dream. So this, the theme is this frailness and impermanence of life expressed in these natural metaphors. But it is exactly this frailness, vulnerability and shortness that makes life sacred. One shouldn't waste time on unimportant things, like, for example, collecting too many belongings, too much money that you can't take with you when you die. The Native Americans have a saying that one should walk in beauty on Mother Earth, And that means not to take more than what is needed and not leaving traces of destruction and death behind one. And that's the same message as the Buddha also said. But sadly, mankind is not following this wise advice. Instead, we're slowly destroying the environment of our home planet Earth in the name of continual economical growth without consideration of nature and its all its ecosystems. And some people hope that science will save us by coming up with some ingenious invention that will make us independent of nature, so that the big corporations can continue destroying it and make more money. But someone said, I saw this quotation on the internet, but I forgot to write down who said it, but I think it was Albert Einstein, you know, the scientist. We know how light rays refract, but the light itself remains a miracle. We know how plants grow, but the plant remains a miracle. We have vast creativity, but creation remains a miracle. So, to make us independent of nature, I think is quite impossible. I once heard this tragicomical definition of our society. The person who has amassed most belongings when they die wins. And most human beings like to hold on to things. We don't like it when our favorite things get lost or stolen or broken or disappear in some way or another. And we don't like to think too much about the facts that we get sick, old, and die, or that our beloved and friends also may die before us and our parents, and that everything is so impermanent. And we don't really want to accept that happiness is replaced by sorrow and vice versa, even if we know on an intellectual level that life is like that. But when it happens to us, we very often feel sad or angry. We suffer, and this is natural, and the Buddha classified this as another characteristic of life, dukkha. Dukkha means suffering. It's also the first noble truth, the very starting point of the Buddha Dhamma. There is suffering in this life, or a better translation may be unsatisfactoriness, since it suffering sounds quite strong, and this dukkha includes all kinds of annoyances in life, both physical and mental, you know, from the smallest mosquito bite to the really big wars and catastrophes. But a lot of this dukkha, especially the mental kind, we create for ourselves by holding on to things and not accepting their changing nature. So tribal people that still exists, that, you know, live very close to nature, they very often celebrate the changing of the seasons or the harvest, the phases of the moon, or the rains, when the rains come, with different ceremonies or feasting of some kind. And it's also common that you celebrate the phases of human life, how we grow from a child to a youth, from a youth to an adult, and from an adult to a wise elder. And this is called rites of passage, and it helps people to understand their role in their community and the way life is always changing. And the phases of the moon is also celebrated in Buddhist countries, especially the full moon. It's called Uposatha days. And then people gather in temples and monasteries and listen to the Dhamma and give food to the monks and chant and whatever. They spend the day, the Uposatha days, in practice. It's said that the Buddha was born, got enlightened, and died on the full moon of the month of May, which is called Vesak in Pali. And then on that full moon, there's really big celebrations in all Buddhist countries. Then that's the biggest Buddhist holiday, you can say. Another traditional Buddhist rite of passage is that all young men and sometimes also young women should spend some time as a novice monk or nun before they get married and established with family, children, work, and so on. So it's a bit similar to a Christian confirmation. They learn the basics of Buddhism and meditation. And some of them might stay as monks and nuns for the rest of their lives if they feel that's their inclination. But most of them go back to a worldly life. So here in this Western, more city-oriented culture, we have removed ourselves from these changes in nature. Not many people that live in big cities could tell you what phase the moon is in if you ask them. Because they never look up in the sky and see the moon. Or if they do, it's usually clouded over with smog or light pollution, too much light, so you can't really see the sky. And we also stay inside a lot, especially in the winter time, of course, in cold countries. Try to stay inside as much as possible, and we protect ourselves from cold or heat with different temperature ACs and things like that. So the temperature stays at a constant, pleasant level. And sadly enough, many children nowadays don't even want to go outside and play. They rather stay indoors and play with their smartphones or iPads. That happened once. Last summer, when I was in my summer house, the plumber came to fix something and he had his grandchild with him. And I said to this kid, "Do you want to go down to the lake or look around here in the forest or something? We don't have to be down in the dark cellar where your grandfather is fixing my tap. And this kid, no, I want to sit in the car and play games with my computer. And it was this fantastic, sunny, nice day. And he seemed completely scared when I suggested going out, but maybe he was scared of me, I don't know. Anyway. The more we try to protect ourselves from this inevitable law of change, the more we seem to suffer, both mentally and psychologically, greed, insensitivity, egotism, materialism, and fears of different kinds is what we develop when we can't accept this simple fact that everything in life comes and goes, and that actually nothing is safe and secure, and there is no guarantee of constant happiness. So we live in this illusion of being separate individuals who can decide exactly what we want to do with our lives. And many people don't even understand that they are totally dependent on this intricate web of interconnectedness that makes up our planet. The natural world produces raw materials to all the things we need to survive. But some people still believe that nature, the animals, the trees, the plants, the stones, and the soil itself is sort of without sentient life, and that it can be treated and exploited without any respect. And this is the materialistic worldview that many of us have grown up with. And this way of perceiving life gives rise to one of the greatest illusions of all, that we human beings are somehow superior to all the rest of the beings, and that only we have a separate, eternal, and unchanging soul or essence that is our real core. But when we look really close and deep, like the Buddha did, we can understand that this isn't true. What we really have is this illusion of having a self or ego that we create in every moment of identification with thoughts, ideas, emotions, plans, memories, whatever it is that comes up in our minds. We create this owner of these things, this I, that doesn't really exist. And this created self believes that it's in charge of my life, my choices, my actions. But in reality, there are so many conditions beyond our control that what the self or the ego actually does is try to adapt itself to the recent situations and make the best of it. And then we believe that we had some control anyway, because we sort of forget about that we didn't really decide this, but we made the best out of the situation. But we still believe that we're in control, because we are the product of this, and we are completely dependent on all these complicated processes of life that surrounds us. If any detail or happening in the past had been different, if your grandmother hadn't met your grandpa, we might not have been sitting here now, all of us, in these human bodies. And if nothing can in fact exist without all the rest, can we then be separate, independent individuals? The Buddha contemplated this and came to the realization that we are processes who are part of other processes, who are part of even bigger processes of life and death. And he called this phenomenon anatta, not self. And this is the third characteristic of life, that there is no inherent core in anything that stays the same all the time. Everything is always changing. So actually there is this little list hidden in this talk about nature. And it's a very important list, actually. The three characteristics is really important insights that we get in this practice. Sannicca is the impermanent and changing nature of all things. And dukkha is the inherent suffering or unsatisfactoriness in life. And anatta is the lack of a separate, unchanging soul or essence or self in these unending processes of life. And these are the three characteristics. And as we practice, we become more and more familiar with these phenomena in our own body and mind. And it's not always pleasant insights we get, but they will sooner or later lead us to the gate of understanding and awakening. So when you experience difficult times in your life or in your meditation practice, you're actually seeing these three characteristics of life and the first noble truth of dukkha. So remember that this is a glimpse of the greatest of insights. One autumn Sunday like this, except it's not Sunday today, but one autumn day like this, I was at home in Stockholm and I was feeling a little bit sad and lonely and how you can feel sometimes life is a bit boring. And so I decided to go for a walk in, I have a park quite near where I live, Hagaparken. And the weather seemed quite okay at first, at least when I looked out through my window. And there was a low slanting yellow sunlight. There was a fairly strong wind blowing when I came out on the street and walked towards the park. And soon these big black clouds came piling in from the north. And when I reached the waterfront in the park, in the bay of Brunnsviken, I was met by this really fantastic, beautiful view. There was a shimmering rainbow that formed this bridge over the water. And the low sun was still giving the landscape this beautiful yellow, warm color. But the water was very dark, black, grayish, because it was reflecting the storm clouds. And there was a couple of swans on this water, and they just glowing with this, the rays of this setting sun. So it was so beautiful. I was just standing there, fascinated by this. And then I saw how these storm clouds came closer, and suddenly the sun disappeared behind the clouds, and it started to rain a little bit as I was walking home with this big grin on my face. I was wondering why I suddenly had changed my whole mood and outlook on life, because nothing had happened really. But I think that the healing power of nature can be this kind of experience where you have this feeling of awe, and you actually feel quite small and insignificant, but still part of something bigger, something greater. And when you stand there watching this storm approaching, or maybe a fantastic sunset, or some other of these natural phenomena, it doesn't matter what your name is or your position in society. And the self, or this imagined self, is completely forgotten for a while. You forget to be someone, and you're just present here and now with what your experience is. And this is when we get a glimpse of this anatta feeling, the feeling of no self. And we really feel that we're not separate beings who can exist independent of our environment. We are part of this great process that is happening. And to feel this connection, to belong totally in the universe, if only for a short moment, it releases this feeling of joy and peace, which can also be more established with practice and insights. There is a poem by Tomas Tranströmer, the Nobel Prize winning Swedish poet, that also captures a similar moment like this, the one I described to you. And it's also in the autumn, set in the autumn. Suddenly the hiker meets the old giant oak tree. Like a petrified moose with endless antlers in front of the September's ocean's blackish green fortress. Northern storm, it is the time when rowan berries ripen. Awake in the dark, you hear the constellations stomping in their stalls high above the tree. And Carlos Castaneda, I don't know if you, he wrote this book, series of book about the sorcerer Don Juan in set in Mexico, and about his sort of spiritual journey, shamanistic spiritual journey. And he writes in one of these books, one called Tales of Power, that is the wise sorcerer Don Juan says to his apprentice Carlos. Only if one loves this earth with unending passion can one release one's sadness. A warrior is always joyful because his love is unalterable and his beloved, the earth, bestows upon him inconceivable gifts. Only the love for this splendorous being can give freedom to a warrior's spirit. And freedom is joy, efficiency, and abandon in the face of any odds. So that's quite strong description of this, our connection to the earth. So nature can really be a great source of inspiration and understanding, because there we can easily come in close contact with these cycles of life, death, and rebirth. And the Buddha knew this very well, of course, and he always told his monks and nuns to go out and meditate in the forest, to sit under the trees, and to learn from the wisdom of the great Mother Earth. So I want to close with a poem by a Finnish poet called Eva Kilpi. And I'm going to read it first in English, and then Ilka will read the original in Finnish. So, in English then, the name of the poem is If You Just Sit Quiet. If you just sit quiet and look, eventually you will understand what everyone thinks, understand what the trees want to say, what bothers the plants, hear how rare berries bemoan their relatives. Learn to interpret the animals' movements, glances. How seldom do we look the animals in the eyes? In their eyes, the world is wider than all our descriptions. We have never done justice to the animals, seriously tried to realize how their lives unfold. The whole time they have, with their inner being, tried to tell us, assumed that we want to listen. Those fir trees leave me no rest. They know they will die. And before that, they want to transmit their knowledge to me, making me their heir. A quiet contemplation widens the world's boundaries. Together with plants, in the company of animals, words don't close any gates.
Hiljaa katsomista. Kun vain katsoo ja on hiljaa, ymmärtää vähitellen kaikkien mielen, tajuaa, mitä puut haluavat sanoa, mikä kasveja huolestuttaa, kuulee, kuinka harvinaiset marjat itkevät sukuaan, oppii lukemaan eläinten liikkeitä, katseita. Miten harvoin me katsomme eläimiä silmiin? Niiden silmissä on maailma, avarampi kuin kaikkien selityksemme. Me emme ole koskaan tehneet niille oikeutta, yrittäneet todella oivaltaa, millaista niiden elämä on. Koko ajan ne ovat koettaneet olemuksellaan kertoa sitä meille, pitäneet selvänä, että haluamme kuulla. Nuo kuuset eivät jätä minua rauhaan. Ne tietävät kuolevansa ja haluavat sitä ennen jättää minulle tietonsa. Tehdä minusta perillisensä. Hiljaa katsominen avaa maailmojen rajat. Kasvien kanssa, eläinten seurassa, ei puhe sulje portteja.
Thank you. So, should we sit a few minutes and contemplate this?